This is Ethanolive Internet Radio, www.ethanolive.com.
Simple Flight Radio, ready for takeoff.
What do you think about flying? Is it a sport? A business? Is it easy or difficult? Is it boring or exciting? Alan Waterloo and Mark Eppner think it may be any of those things, but they like to make it simple. This is Simple Flight Radio, where Mark and Al talk about the many aspects of aviation and the amazing people doing amazing things to make this world a better place.
Woohoo! Guess what? It is Sunday night. That means it's time for Simple Flight Aviation Radio. I'm Al Waterloo with Mr. Mark Eppner. How you doing, Mark?
Wonderful. And I'm really wondering, do we really make the world a better place? That's what it says on the intro.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, then I'm good with that. I buy that.
I recycled my water bottles today.
That does make the world a better place.
You better believe it.
I'll have to bring my water bottles over to your house.
Yeah, well, come on over. The more the more recyclables, the merrier.
You're going to have trouble with those new teeth of yours tonight, aren't you? What? You're stumbling over your words.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah. I hope the dentures stick for the entire show. But I think we got a great show tonight. But of course, as always, we're live from the KPWK Airport on KPWK Radio.
I wonder, are we allowed to say that? I think we should use it. It really sounds real. And even though our listenership is only about 14 million people.
Yeah.
Yeah, woohoo.
Yeah, that's a lot of people.
That is a lot of people.
But, yeah, well, I think it's a great little... But we're on the wrong side of the Mississippi to be KPWK Radio.
Well, that's kind of changed. That's the way it was. It's a start out with the W's to the east and the K's to the west, but there are exceptions. And certainly
are there,
we are,
really?
Yeah, and we're an exceptional show.
Yes.
An exceptional duo.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, right.
We're like three amigos minus an amigo.
That's right. We're the legends in our own mind.
Yeah, exactly. Legends and leaders.
What's the Big Ten now? Legends and...
Legends and leaders.
Oh, is it legends and leaders?
Yeah.
That from two Big Ten alum.
Exactly. Me from the University of Illinois and Mark from...
the University of Iowa.
Yeah, exactly.
But go Hawks.
Yeah, at go Hawks. Boo.
Oh, no, man.
Yeah, boo.
No.
Go Illini. Fighting Illini.
Stop it.
Yep. But anyway, we got a great show tonight. And like we said earlier, we're live from the KPWK Airport. If you don't know where that is, pull out your JEP chart or your 4Flight app. You'll be able to find exactly where we're broadcasting live from, specifically the Signature FBO conference room.
And as always, we like to give our thanks and kudos to Signature Flight Sport. They are very kind in giving us the fishbowl, the video studio with all the windows, all the glass out into the ramp. We have a throng of fans sitting outside waving to us as they fly by. They rock their wings. And it couldn't be possible
exactly
without Signature Flight Support. So thank you, Signature.
Thank you very much. And we got a nice looking airplane out there on the ramp tonight, don't we?
It looks like a 414. Is that a 414?
That's a 414.
Yeah, with little wingtips. Nice, and it looks actually like it's relatively new. It's got a nice paint job on it.
Not bad. And I can kind of see. I thought there was only one airplane on the ramp, but through the reflection of the window, I see a tri-engine business jet. Name a tri-engine business jet.
A Falcon 50.
Falcon 50.
And then the newer ones, like a Falcon
900.
Yeah.
7X. So it looks like through the reflection, a little somebody from the Falcon family sitting on the other side of the ramp.
That's a nice airplane.
It is.
That was one of my favorites as a young man. At that point, it was just the Falcon 50 way back then, but because it had a tri-jet and reminded me of a 727.
Ooh, good airplane. Good airplane.
Yeah.
But you know what else is one of my favorites?
What's that?
The Sunday night chuckle.
Uh-oh. The pressure's on.
The pressure is on. You know what? This has become an a good indicator if I'm going to get a good night's sleep or not tonight is how hard I laugh from the Sunday night chuckle.
Uh-oh, now the pressure's really
Yeah, up. Exactly. Insomnia or not?
Well, tonight's Sunday night chuckle actually comes from a little bit... Well, let's just say it comes from the airline industry because it involves flight attendants, and we all love flight attendants in one fashion or another.
Yeah.
And especially since our special guest has a link to the airlines, which, of course, where we see most of the flight attendants. And I one thing I love about in the airlines, in aviation, is the amount of pride that we see
yes.
around. And I'm reminded of one captain who had a lot of pride in his crew. And they, the airline, which will remain nameless at this point, had hired a flight attendant, right? I haven't even told the joke. Why are you laughing? I like your enthusiasm, though.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
Yeah, well, hired this flight attendant, and I'm not going to give a gender. We'll just say that the flight attendant was really good eye candy, if you catch my drift. Really nice
yeah, okay.
to look at.
Yeah.
But had a reputation, even though this flight attendant was brand new, of not having a lot upstairs, right? Nice, kind of a nice house, no lights on, what, nobody home, whatever, or lights on, nobody's home, whatever, I can't even say it. So the captain, though, wanted to make this flight attendant feel as part of the team.
Yeah.
And so the captain said, you know what, tonight, I'm going to show you, because we have our first overnight, I'm going to show you where all the aircraft or airliner personnel, the favorite places to eat, favorite places to go, favorite places to stay overnight.
That's being a good crew member.
Oh, man, yeah, a real mentor, leader, and,
yeah.
and take the flight attendant under the captain's wing. And so everything went well, and then the next morning as they were preparing, the crew was preparing to leave, noticed that flight attendant wasn't there.
Oh, man.
And the captain was very worried, and so he thought, well, maybe the flight attendant's still at the hotel. So he called the hotel, and the hotel, you know, answered and transferred him to the room. And sure enough, the flight attendant answered, and she was sobbing, crying.
Oh, no.
And the captain said, oh, my God, what's wrong? And she said, I can't get out of my room. He said, what? You can't get out of your room? Why not? And she said, well, there's only three doors to get out. One is the bathroom, one is the closet, and the other one has a sign on it that says, do not disturb.
Wow.
Ooh.
Man. Well, that's a, yeah. you know, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm also reminded of the person that locked themselves inside of the car, but that's for a different show.
Is that, did you lock yourself in a car?
No, I've never locked myself
you
in a car.
You know what?
I did lock my son when, right now he's 29, but when he was a very small baby, we locked him in the car.
Oh,
he locked
man.
Himself.
Wow.
We'd just gotten out. I had thrown the keys over to him. He was playing with them. It's hot in a parking lot. And I run around, and meanwhile, he twists the little knob to lock it. He's like, I don't know, 4 years old, something
wow.
like that, 3 years old. And I couldn't unlock it. And it was like 100 degrees in there. This was, actually, we must have had a cell phone, but it was in the 80s. Anyway, bottom line, I was just about to break the glass to get into the
yeah.
car, and someone actually went to the store, dialed a payphone, called my wife, and she drove it over. But... It was so stupid. I didn't think that he even knew how to... He only knew how to lock the door. He didn't know how to unlock it. Anyway, that has nothing to do with aviation, so thank you for that digression. And let's
yeah, you're welcome. But but I've got a locking story
okay.
that is aviation-related.
Good. Let's quickly move away from mine.
Did you know that I once locked myself in an airplane?
No. How do you do that?
You do it very, very carefully. And it's not one of my prouder moments, but it did happen.
You have to tell me how. I can't just let you get away with that.
So, anyway, I was out. It's kind of a good story. Looking back on it, I realized, wow, I should have put two and two together, but I didn't. It was more in the name of comfort. But anyway, let's rewind a couple years back when I was at college at the University of Illinois down in Champaign. I used to work as a gate agent, customer service agent, ramp agent, they call them CSAs, customer service agents, that basically did everything at the airport, loaded luggage and all that. But anyway, it was Christmas Eve.
Wow.
It was Christmas Eve. It was really cold out in Champaign, and I was going to treat myself to a warm airplane while I cleaned it. It was the last flight of the night. And
what kind of airplane?
It was a Saab Fairchild 340.
Okay.
Twin propeller, 34-passenger model. It was a B-plus model, 34 people, 34 seats. So the last flight came in. I finished up all the baggage claims and put out all the luggage and all that. But part of my closing duties was to clean the airplane, do a security sweep for the next, for the plane to stay overnight, and then the morning crew would have clean airplane and be ready to go to board.
Absolutely.
Well, it was really cold out, and I decided, you know what, I'm going to hook up the heat cart, which blows hot, you know, warm air. So
makes sense for the heat cart to have some heat. But
yeah, it sure does.
I'm glad I'm with you.
Yeah, good thing it wasn't cool. But anyway, so we get on. I get on the plane, and there's another guy with me cleaning the plane, and I hook up the heat cart, which you have to go underneath the belly, plug that yellow hose in, turn the heat on, get up, and I shut the door. I'm like, you know what? Normally I didn't shut the door, but tonight I did, just because, you know, I just wanted to stay warm because I was up front near the door. So I go ahead, I shut the door, and then all of a sudden, when I shut the door shut, my ears start to pop. And they kept popping, and things got really quiet. And my coworker came running up, like, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" He says, "Open the door! Open the door!" And so I go to try to open the door, and I couldn't open the door. I had pressurized myself shut in this airplane.
It's kind of like in the old days when you used to penny someone into their dorm room. You were pennied in, but
I was. I was pennied, but with 14 pounds of per square inch of air pressure, and I was afraid that I was going to pump too much air in, the plane was going to explode, I couldn't open the door, and all that. So the door was just, it was held shut by the air pressure. I couldn't believe it.
So how did you figure out how to get out? We got to get a happy ending. Well,
well, anyway, there was a, I couldn't open the door. I went up into the cockpit. I'm like, oh, shoot. So what I started to do, I started to fire up the radios in the airplane to call ground control to have the fire trucks come out.
That would have been embarrassing.
Yeah, that would have been embarrassing. But there was a little hole. They called it the whiskey hole. And near the captain's like left hand, if you were to put his hands on his knees and touch the side of the airplane, there's a little hole there. They call it the whiskey hole.
Okay.
And you would pass paperwork in and out of that little hole. So I took a headset, a spare headset, and I used it to pry open this door. And I cracked it just enough, and all of a sudden you hear this whoosh. And the plane depressurized itself. We kept the hole open, and that way we were able to get the
door
open.
Actually, that was pretty smart to do.
Yeah, well, I wanted to try to get the hole open with my hand, and I couldn't get it open.
That's funny. Yeah, no, that was pretty smart after such a dumb thing.
Yeah. I was solving non-problems.
Yeah. Creation of a problem and solving of a problem.
Yeah, so anyway, I locked myself into an airplane before.
And that makes sense now. I was trying to visualize all these things, and now that I hear it, yeah, I guess we could all do that.
Yeah.
But none of us do. Only you.
Well, I think I've battened 3 for 3 for making you laugh, but I think tonight's laugh was out of my own stupidity.
Well, you know what? As long as you reach the goal, it doesn't really matter how you got there.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Well, maybe that we could check the box of true confessions as well.
Yeah, that's actually, I'm trying to think of one for me, but I'd rather not, so let's move on. Yeah.
Done. All right.
Over, done with, gone.
Exactly. Well, you know what? October 21st was kind of a neat day for aviation. I wouldn't say that it was action-packed.
Yeah, but certainly every day is something that went on in aviation.
Every day something happened in aviation. And did you know what happened in this day in aviation?
Yeah, I know a few things, but I can't wait to hear what yours is.
What happened?
Well, for mine, I would tell you and ask you what happened in 1929, October 21st, 1929.
October 21st, 1929.
And you'll never get it. But it was a first in civilian aviation, and that is the Colonial Flying Service, and Scully Walton Ambulance Company organized the United States' first civilian air ambulance service.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. 1929 on October 21st.
That's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, it's one of those trivia things that you go, hey, that's good to know.
That is really good to know. And I'm pretty... Well, that's really good to know because I didn't realize that air ambulances were... I guess that old.
Yeah, no, when I first read that, believe me, this is not something I just knew coming into this show. I was surprised, too. But yeah, 1929, and first civilian would suggest maybe from a military perspective or something that it did exist before that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's really, really cool, and I applaud the foresight to those two organizations coming together to create such a valuable thing that's with us even today.
Exactly. Well, I think that's it's an incredible. Think of all the different derivatives of that's how that's turned itself into the. Have you ever heard of a lifeguard airplane on the radio?
Yeah.
And then you hear what's it? Angel Flight.
Angel Flight. Yep. NGF is the call sign, and Lifeline Pilots, and all of that. And actually, when you use the Angel Flight, because I happen to be an Angel Flight pilot, although I'm embarrassed to say how little I've flown them. You do get priority handling.
Yeah.
And sometimes you even get fuel discounts.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
I didn't know about the fuel discounts.
Yeah, you just when you get to the FBO and you fill up, just tell them it's an Angel Flight, and sometimes they throw a discount at you, which is very appreciative.
Yeah.
Appreciated.
Absolutely. That's really great. Well, here's one.
Yeah.
Here's something that happened in 1970. And this didn't happen in the States, but the British United Airways merged with Caledonian Airlines, which became the British Caledonian Airlines.
I remember that airline.
Do you really remember?
Yeah, 1970. I was kind of in high school.
Wow. Wow. But do you know what that actually ended up becoming? It was the precursor, Caledonian Airlines.
British Airways?
Was the precursor of British Airways, which that airline on this day in 1986... became it was owned by the British government, and British government put it up for sale.
Oh, cool. And something else to lock away and that I can soon forget. But
exactly. you could be on Jeopardy.
Only if it's tonight, because by tomorrow I've forgotten.
Well, you need to brush up on your airline, your international airline aviation history.
I'll make sure I do that before I apply to get on Jeopardy.
Exactly. Yeah. But anyway, we had that was back then. You said something from 29. I said something from 1970. What about today or this week in aviation?
Oh, my God.
Do anything pretty cool?
This has been... I don't know how to describe it, just a week of heaven. I've gotten a decent amount of flying this week. I started it just going up, practicing approaches, had a ball. Yesterday I got to go visit my son, my daughter-in-law. My other son was in town. This is in Cedar Rapids. My granddaughter, and in an SR-22, so I got to shoot. I mean, his beautiful sun shined, but there was this little deck at about 700 foot. So I got to shoot an ILS approach, which made it wonderful. And then today, I know someone named Al Waterloo that checked me out in the new airplane, the Sky Arrow.
The Sky Arrow?
Yeah. I was anxious in both senses of the word, because I wasn't sure in this little thing, but it was really an easy
airplane. Or flying with me?
Well, that too. I mean, it's tough to get into an airplane and be at gross weight before we put in fuel. I'm sorry. I'm just kidding.
Ouch.
You.
Wow. I didn't know it was going to be that kind of show tonight.
Yeah, either did I. And I apologize. That was trying to get a second chuckle out tonight.
Yeah.
But I had a blast in that airplane. And so I got to this airport at 8:30 this morning. It's 8:20 now, so almost 12 hours I've been at the airport and multiple airplanes, and it's like one of the greatest days.
That's awesome.
I'm excited. So how about you?
I really enjoyed that flight. I thought it was kind of, that's a neat airplane. It flies a lot like a glider, and just the visibility. It just brings back the raw fun of just being airborne.
The visibility. It was fun. I agree.
Yeah, absolutely.
How about your week?
Well, since we flew the Sky Air today, I also had this was a land-based activity, but it was aviation related. Had a great, almost, it was actually a very impactful simulator session with a student of mine working on his instrument ticket.
Oh, that's neat. I always love even going to the simulator. It doesn't quite have the feeling of being up and seeing the same scenery and all, but you know, it's just fun to fly the thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was kind of neat because I really liked the simulator because I felt like my old clarinet teacher today, or yesterday, because I was, as soon as you would make a mistake, it's like, okay, let's start over and do it again. And the simulator allows you to do that.
Right.
And you get through the task and you practice it a million times and you know it by the back of your hand. When you're done. So it was a really great day for the student. I felt really great. You know, the student felt fantastic, and it was such a great feeling.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Well, congratulations to the student. I mean, he got it. He was the one doing all the work. It was awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah, very good. But anyway, we had a special guest just join us.
Everyone's looking over their shoulder.
Yeah, where is this guy? No, it's Mr. Bob Schmelzer. He just came in. Bob, how you doing tonight?
Hello there.
Right, get close to the microphone.
Hello.
There we go.
Yeah.
Kind of like a mic in the 777.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I don't know. I was waiting for the cameras. I don't see any cameras.
Well, we did that a few weeks ago. I got to figure out how to take 2 hours of video and post it online.
You guys are so funny.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let me get hooked up here. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
That's why I had tried to set it up ahead of you.
Yeah. Well, we have usually, I don't know if you know this, but Bob, but
I'm sure he listens to the show all the time.
I have listened to it.
Oh, good. Yeah. Excellent.
Usually it's past my bedtime, so.
Well, you can listen to us on iTunes or at simpleflight.net as an archive.
Absolutely.
Yeah, what I've heard has been very enjoyable.
Good. Yeah. Well, we're glad. Glad you could be here tonight. But
likewise.
So we have a weather report, and this one was inspired by you tonight, Mr. Bob Schmelzer. And we got if we were to go down and find where two things happen. I guess is it Orville Rickenbacker?
Rickenbacker.
Are
you talking about
popcorn
the popcorn guy?
Yeah,
popcorn not guy. The guy, the Red Baron.
Yeah. Oh, jeez, I'm
popcorn?
Sorry.
Mr. Popcorn. Redenbacher.
Redenbacher.
Oh. Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Rickenbacker's had something to do with aviation.
That's it. Yeah, that's a... And I think you learned how to fly out of here.
Did, or I did?
Or you did. At the Valparaiso, Indiana Airport?
Yeah. Is that the Rickenbacker Airport?
No, that's in Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah, we used to call it Valpo, but yeah, Valparaiso, VPZ.
VPZ.
So in honor of Bob, I think we're going to get some weather from VPZ.
Yeah, we're going to see what tonight, what is going on tonight at Valpo.
I bet it's good.
Yeah, let's see what's going
on. I hope so. It's good here.
Right down the lake. Kurt, take a...
Wind 130 at 06. Oh, visibility 10. Sky condition clear. Temperature 14 Celsius. Dew point 09 Celsius. Altimeter 3001. Remarks. Thunderstorm. Information not available.
Oops.
Porter County Municipal Airport, Valparaiso, Indiana.
Valparaiso. Wow. I always say Valparaiso.
Weather
wow.
0124 Zulu. Wind 130 at 06.
Very cool.
130 at 06. So, Bob, what runway would you use down there?
That would be runway 9.
Runway 9. All right.
Or runway 17.
Excellent.
You have your choice.
All right.
Oh, is it 18 or 17? It's been so long.
Well, it probably has changed.
It might be 18, actually, but runway 9 is a long one. That's the one the opposite end of the one I soloed on.
Yeah.
I soloed on 27.
All right.
And I was 16 years old, I was so scared. I was sitting down there praying. You know.
And he's not a religious man.
Well, you know,
maybe
really,
you were.
Not
I'm
as
just
religious as I ought to be, I think.
We could all say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good. So it sounds like it's a nice day out in Valpo, and
a beautiful airport.
Too. Yeah, it is. It really is a nice airport.
But thank you for inviting me tonight, guys.
Yeah.
It's an honor to be here.
Absolutely.
See you guys working on your non-aviation role for a change.
I've been doing a lot of this, and I love it. This is what I look forward to. Like I said, a Sunday all day at the airport.
Well, when you were talking before about how you got here at 8 o'clock this morning and you've been all day at the airport flying, I'm going, welcome to my world.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. Well, I think we've all – it's interesting. It's been I think it's been a really fun day at the airport today.
It's been
a long day, but it's been a fun day, I've enjoyed every second.
I had two students as well.
That's awesome.
Oh, good.
And I just got done from a flight, an instrument student, and before that, in the simulator too. So we all had simulator experience here.
I didn't.
You can spell simulator.
I can spell. I can probably spell it backwards.
And I just got back from 4 days in the simulator at Denver with my other company, United.
I guess we weren't sure if we should mention his name.
That's right. Yeah. My company, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, I think, well, that's great. The simulator tools are pretty cool. I think the simulator that we were in today, or you were in today, and I was in yesterday, the Redbird,
yeah.
How do you like that?
I'm learning to operate it. It's a little bit challenging for me. I like things that really fly, but the simulator is definitely a great tool for certain things, especially when you're practicing things you wouldn't want to be doing in the real airplane.
I hear you.
Engine failures in a 777 airplane. But today the Redbird's a single-engine land airplane, and we did a VFR hop just to review some procedures for a guy that hadn't flown for 30 years, so he's getting back into it.
Oh, that's exciting.
He got his private rating in Canada, so now he's going to convert to a U.S. pilot certificate. So getting started all over again, but review. So
that's pretty
cool. It was a good tool for him today.
Yeah.
Perfect tool.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. So what is the process it has to go into converting a license like that? Do you have to take a check ride and all that?
We thought we did, but no. We found out that all he has to do is take the private knowledge test.
Really?
He has to take that, and then it's more or less just a flight review. He has to get a medical certificate and a flight review, and he's good to go. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's not as complicated as we thought, so we're very happy to have found that out.
Yeah, that's also good to know, a little trivia for us when we're on Jeopardy.
Exactly.
That's really good.
A good pilot is always learning.
I've heard you say that about 4,000 times.
Yeah, and it's so true.
And it is so true.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Bob, it's absolute pleasure to have you on the show tonight. I think that, you know, Mark and I are in pursuit of finding amazing people doing amazing things in aviation, and it's... When we sat down and thought of a list of people who fit that bill, we definitely thought of you in many different retrospects, because just like that, you're helping a guy that's converting a Canadian license to a U.S. license. That's really cool. But I think that we also, you know, one thing that really sticks out with me is that you experience aviation on multiple different levels. You're a 777 check airman, you're a DPE, designated pilot examiner, and you're a CFI. So you get to have fun in aviation in all three different levels.
And he's an author also. He writes for AOPA Flight Training Magazine.
You just can't get enough of this stuff, huh?
Yeah.
Well, some people can and some people can't. I think the three of us are on the latter side of that, just can't get enough.
I think all three of us were always... aviation nerds. Well, can't get enough of it.
Actually, so I got to take a quick aside, and this is going to show where I think you and I are aligned. I'm taking a leap here. So I'm going to ask Al first, what's your favorite aviation-related TV show? Even thinking in the past.
Thinking in the past.
Or
future,
whatever. You're a young man, so it's somewhat limited. But
well, I bought, you know what I did is I bought the full season to... Flying Wild Alaska.
Well, I recorded them. I could have just sold it to you from my house.
I thought that I thought that was a pretty cool show because it exposed a different element of aviation.
I love that show.
You know, that's really cool to see from a pilot's perspective, as well as it told a really cool story of how I think aviation, you know, is a lifeline and a support and a backbone for communities in Alaska. That, hey, aviation is really that important. If it went away, a lot of these villages would go away. So that's just to hear some of the stories behind
that. It is amazing. I get cold just thinking about that show.
Yeah.
By the way, I was born in Alaska.
Were you really?
You didn't know that, did you?
Oh, no, my goodness.
Anchorage, Alaska, my hometown.
Oh, my. Well, we've got a lot to talk about after the show.
Oh, boy.
So, growing up, did you have a favorite show or even today?
My favorite, you're gonna laugh, and you're going to say maybe this doesn't qualify, but my favorite aviation show, not Sky King, I know that's what you're thinking. No, Star Trek. That's kind of aviation related, right? You know, it's futuristic. You get it. You're off the ground. You're way off the ground, but... And I still enjoy the Star Trek shows, The Next Generation, because similar to, like, if you take Captain Picard and that, this is really weird, but, in our world of flying airliners around, it's kind of like, you know, it can be kind of like, you know, navigating a starship.
Yeah.
You know, watch out for the black holes and all that stuff. But, that was my show, and my wife got me all of the DVDs for the show. We still watch that and been through it two or three times.
That's pretty cool. So when you're flying the 777, do you say computer?
Computer.
Yeah, computer.
Warp speed.
Yeah, and it doesn't talk back to me. Unless I do something wrong.
Unless I messed up here. Let me try something here.
Oh, what's that?
Out of the blue of the western sky comes Sky King.
And Skybird.
We say here in the west,
Songbird.
Greek partner,
Penny.
Reach Bonabisco. Reach Bonabisco.
You guys are weird.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I have them. He had multiple airplanes. I gotta finish this commercial.
Is this an Oreo cookie commercial?
Oreo cream sandwich. They changed the name.
Excuse me. Lorna Doone.
I did not know that.
Those great taste in coconut chocolate.
Anyway,
drop cookies.
Okay.
And yeah. Well, that's neat.
So yeah, so Sky King was my favorite, and I see the Cessna 310, which was my favorite of all his airplanes. He did like a C-50. I don't even know. It looked like a Beech-18 to me.
Mm-hmm.
But had so many, and I just...
That was a bamboo bomber, I think, right? The Cessna C-50.
I think you're right. I do
fixed think. Gear, fixed pitch prop. You lose one, the good engine takes you to the scene of the accident.
Exactly. A little Sunday night chuckle from him.
Yeah. Yeah.
The bamboo bomber, yeah.
The bamboo bomber. I remember seeing that. So, okay, if we're going to expose...
what about Al here? What was your favorite?
It was definitely the Flying Wild Alaska for the TV show. But if we're going to expose aviation nerdy secrets, I gotta share that I was on the competitive aircraft recognition flight team in college. Mm. And that we actually talked about the C-50 bamboo bomber, and that was during our little Cessna study practice.
Wow.
Yeah, it was kind of
And how old were you when this all happened?
I was in my prime of 19, 20, 21. Yeah, okay.
I thought you were going to say 8 or 9.
Yeah. Hey, what it did get was a hall pass from finals week at college, because then we'd travel and go compete competitively against other universities.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
But anyway, that was through NIFA. Have you ever heard of NIFA?
NIFA, no.
NIFA, it's a National Intercollegiate Flying Association. It's like they had competitive flying events, spot landings contests, navigation, how to use an E6B, like VFR scan or VFR sectional questions, and you know, get in the real nitty gritty of stuff like that. It was neat. It was fun. Anyway, exposing the nerdy secrets of the Simple Flight Radio.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But. Anyway, I think I'm pretty excited to have you on the show here tonight, because you have this very awesomely diverse background in aviation. You know, we said that you're a Czech airman on the 777. You're a DPE pilot examiner. and you're a flight instructor. So I guess my first question is really, why? That's an awesome one resume, but two, you got to be pretty passionate to still maintain all three of those.
Yeah, that's what got me here. My passion and my love for aviation, and like I said, when you start that young, it's hard not to, you know, when you do like Mark here and you guys out at the airport every day, it's hard not to keep learning. So with that passion and learning, you climb one rung at a time. You start as, you know, I thought I would never have the day where I would look back and say, wow, I did all that. Yeah, you're saying all this, you're talking about me?
Yeah.
Is this really me? Because I remember very clearly the days when I was just starting off in Valparaiso.
Yeah.
You know, you made me think about that today, my first solo, and still very clear. We all start at the bottom. So sometimes students say, oh, they look at me and go, oh, I'll never get there. Well, you know, it's just like laying a brick wall. It's one brick at a time, 1 hour at a time, you know.
Yeah, right.
It just keep on going. And for me, it was one rating after the other, you know, private, instrument, multi-engine, then the CFI, you know, commercial, all that stuff. And the next thing you know, you're doing it for a living. So never look back. I loved every minute of it, and still very happy / lucky, honored to be where I am. And
yeah.
In fact, day after tomorrow, I'm going to Seattle for 3 days of line check airman training with United. So we're still learning that now, too. So,
well,
you never run out of things to learn.
Other than a quick little ride with you in a 777 sim, I'm always in the backside of the airliners. And I've had the opportunity to sit down with pilots that are deadheading, not necessarily on United, but multiple airlines. I would suggest they don't have the same attitude. Some seem very tired and frustrated with the industry.
So yes,
You know, it's like they do their job and then they go home and can't wait till retirement comes.
And you're seeing a very small window of that. I get to fly sitting next to these guys all the time, the guys you're referring to. Not everybody has our enthusiasm for aviation, unfortunately. But a lot of us do,
of
us especially, and that seems to be for the young people who might be listening out there that might someday be taking over my seat, which incidentally is up for grabs in about 6 years when I reach that magic age of 65. But if you're motivated to become an airline pilot someday, you just keep on going and don't lose that motivation. And one of the things they're going to ask you when you take your interview is, gee, why do you want to be a pilot? And your enthusiasm either does or doesn't come through loud and clear. And if it does, if it's not coming through loud and clear, that's kind of what they're looking for. And I didn't know that when I interviewed with United when I was 24 years old. And the young lady who asked me that question, I didn't know, that's what they were actually looking for. Somebody that could, because I said, and I told her the story. I said, well, this is going to sound so corny, but it's true. I said, actually, you know, when I was a Cub Scout at 10 years old, and we went on a field trip to O'Hare, and we got to go inside of Continental Cockpit 707 cockpit.
Wow.
And that, for me, was like flipping on the light switch. I know what I want to be now. It was like the difference between night and day. Boom, it just happened, and I'm so lucky that happened. And I said, and even in eighth grade, I said, this is the corny part, so hang with me here. You know? I said, in eighth grade, one of the last things we had to do before we graduated was write a little story about what you want to be doing 10 years from now. Where do you want to be? Who do you want to be flying? What are you doing? And I said, well, I want to be an airline pilot, flying captain for United Airlines. And that was what I wrote when I was 14 years old.
Wow.
And, you know, Jan Thomas was the girl who was, you know, asking me that question. She looked at me like, and I thought she was kind of like laughing at me, but no, actually what she was writing on her paper was, yep, this is the kind of guy with these other people. This nerd is okay.
Yeah.
Let's hire him.
Yeah.
Wow.
But after, you know, after I've been at United for many years, and not just United, but a lot of the airlines are the same way. We all get to talk to each other, and you hear my story repeated over and over.
Sure.
From so many people. But on the other side of the coin, Mark, you were alluding to airline pilots who sometimes don't have they don't demonstrate a very high level of, like, gee, this is exciting. Why am I here? Yeah, the industry has changed quite a bit, and I know Al probably wants to get into that. How has it changed? But it's changed. We've become more bus driver-like,
right.
But that doesn't mean we have to feel that way about it. Just because the industry kind of sees us as bus drivers, I don't see myself as a bus driver. When you go to work to fly a 777 airliner or any airplane for that matter, it's very different from driving a bus.
Oh,
and so
absolutely.
And
yeah.
I don't know many buses that drive from Chicago to Shanghai either.
No, that's a long ride. But yeah, you can lose some of the excitement. But on the other side of the coin, it's a very exciting job to have, and it's
absolutely
the only job I would ever want to do. And you know, people say, "What's your favorite job?" I'm doing it.
Yeah,
you know. Professional
but
pilot.
You have three jobs as a professional pilot, and Al alluded to it. I mean, the 777 captain is what I would think many today and in the past would aspire to, yet you continue to get into a single-engine, four-seat, piston airplane with a smile on your face, or a simulator.
Yeah. And still enjoy it. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Certainly it appears that you enjoy it. So
yeah,
where does that come from? And tell us a little bit about
that.
I think a lot of that is
you know, how I started in general aviation. I didn't start as a military pilot. I think a lot of military pilots that I fly with that I know would be reluctant to get in a light aircraft because they don't have that experience. But I started off in a Cherokee 140, you know, four-seat, single-engine, little tiny airplane.
Yeah, a Cherokee 140 is more two seats, the two little kitty seats in the
back.
Yeah,
the two seats are just in the back for putting your flight case back there. Yeah. They're not actually for carrying people.
Yeah.
Although I did put my mother through several training flights, including my first dual cross-country.
Nice.
She'll never forget that either. But I think, to answer your question, the reason I'm coming back, this is my roots. You know, GA flying is how it started out for me. And I've always enjoyed that, and I still do. So I'm back home in a single-engine airplane. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say to me, oh, how can you go from flying a 777 to a little airplane back and forth? Well, it's kind of like the difference between driving a big car and then a little car.
Yeah.
You know, once you know how to drive, you drive them both.
But incumbent in all that, too, is not only driving, but now you got to teach somebody that doesn't know how to fly or wants to get to the next level in their flying goals.
Patience, my friend.
Yeah,
patience.
But, and again, you've been flying for a lot of years, so to come back to that, I don't want to characterize the whole industry, but we see so many flight instructors that are building hours so they can stop instructing.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
they want to get
to
the airlines or the corporate job.
Yeah, if you think of flight instruction as a stepping stone to the next job and you can't wait to do it so you can let your flight instructor certificate expire, that says something about your motivational, you know, thing too. So I never let my CFI expire. I remember how hard it was to get it when I was 18 years old in high school. I graduated with it already in my pocket.
Wow.
When I was a high school senior. Then I started teaching my high school friends to fly all summer long, and so that paid for my college tuition. So not only was I earning some income for college, at the same time I was getting more experience as a pilot, instructor, and having fun. I really never worked for a living. Have I?
Yeah,
no, not at all. It's been great.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. You know, one thing that seems to be kind of like a theme that repeats with you is you never stop learning.
Yes,
a pilot is always learning.
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly I think that's a wonderful demonstration of passion in aviation because it's kind of a curiosity.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So it kind of keeps driving you to different aspects.
And again, you know, one of the first thing they learn as an instructor is that motivation really is the key to all learning. And because I'm so motivated to fly because I love it so much, and I think you guys do too, that's why we're all sitting here tonight.
Yeah.
Instead of watching I Love Lucy reruns.
But, thank God for DVR.
Or Star Trek reruns. You know?
Yeah.
But anyway, no, the motivation is the key to all learning. So because we love it, I think it's a never-ending circle. We're motivated to learn more, and we learn more so we can love it more.
Yeah,
It just feeds on itself.
So. Yeah. Now here's a question. Like from an instructing standpoint, do you find yourself well, you teach people how to fly, but this is one thing that I've particularly really enjoyed as an instructor myself, is to try to get people motivated to learn, you know, more on their own, if that makes any sense. You just kind of, you build that, you pull that passion out of them.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And you get them excited, and then they, then right. Once you open up that door, it's like, boom, there they go.
Well, that's part of our job.
Yeah, it is.
Because, you know, it's easy when the student first shows up on day one. They're very excited. They're very passionate. They want to learn. They're motivated. It's our job as instructors to maintain that motivational level. You know, and it's not easy to do sometimes.
Right.
But especially with the older students who have, you know, families. They have jobs, careers, other things, distractions.
Yeah.
Kids, you know, whatever. All that stuff gets in the way. So it's very easy to start putting their hobby of learning how to fly on the back burner. So it's our job as instructors to keep that passion, keep that fire. You know, if we don't keep on making it more and more enjoyable, suddenly they lose interest, and that's unfortunately where a lot of students are going these days. And part
right.
of it's financial, part of it's probably one third of that responsibility is our job as instructors to keep that passion, that flame burning. Nice.
Yeah,
and high.
What do we see here? 80% dropout rate?
Yeah, I don't even know what the number is, but it's way too high.
Way
too high. A big chunk of that is financial, just the sheer cost of learning how to fly. I mean, I spent in 1970, I don't even know if we should tell anybody this, but only $1,000 is what it took for me from all of it, from start to private pilot license was $1,000. My multi-engine rating was $275.
Wow, I got ripped off.
You pay more for that than just doing the run up, right?
Yeah, right. Pretty much.
But that was 100 years ago. That was.
We were paying 17 wet for a 150, because the 152 hadn't been created yet, and 19 for a 140, which became our new Piper Warrior, where I learned.
It was 19 an hour?
19 an hour.
Mine was 16 an hour at Valparaiso.
And then we went all the way up to 25 an hour for the Piper Arrow, and it was a new one.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool.
And my instructor was $8 an hour, so that's 50% of the cost of the airplane, and that's pretty much what we charge now for as instructors, about 50% of the airplane rate.
Yeah.
So the percentages haven't gone up, but the numbers have.
Yeah.
Thank God we make a little bit more than we used to, too.
Yeah. What do you mean, we?
Well, I try to include myself in your group.
Well, that meant I was below you.
I know. I was trying to shift the table on you. I knew where you were going.
Oh.
But, yeah, you know, I think of it, and it's just not... you talked about the pride and all that, or the passion.
Yeah.
I would say there's pride too, and I see that in you, Bob, and I see that in you, Al, and other people that enjoy it. You take a pride in helping people achieve a goal. Instead of just pulling the passion out, you care about them.
Yeah. That's what's fun for me.
Yeah,
you know, seeing that, seeing people develop.
Actually, absolutely.
We have a little tidbit. Remember when we were at a restaurant near the airport with Bob just a couple weeks ago, and you had a student that was out on a check ride. Remember an instrument check ride? Cirrus?
You'll have to refresh my memory. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It's coming back to me now. Yeah. I'm getting kind of old, you know.
I forgot. I'm kind of old.
Yeah.
But Al and I were talking about this. What was interesting is you taught a lot of people to fly, you've written about it, you've flown it, yet that day it looked like your first student. You were so nervous. Were they going to, not nervous, the anticipation, were they going to pass?
Expectant
father, and we were so
and I was
surprised.
Here all day, I remember now. I came here in the morning to make sure everything was set for him, and and waited around all day, and so I was
it's
so excited to see the result. Well, I knew he was going to pass because he was ready.
Right.
Okay, and that's the way it works out, but I wanted to be there for the delivery. Yeah.
For the crowning moment.
But I didn't get the sense that you knew he was going to pass. I mean, we obviously know you felt confident what you taught him.
Yeah.
But you had a sense of nervousness and anticipation around you that I would expect to see in a rookie.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's very observant of you, and I think you hit the nail on the head.
Well, no, I think that says something pretty neat about, you know, being an instructor, is that, you know, hey, there's a really deep element of caring and taking ownership of, you know, a student's goal to get the job done. And
it's not just a job.
I mean,
it's a passion. It's a passion for aviation to see people learn and develop, and that's where I was that day.
Yeah, that was
I wasn't
awesome.
Teaching him anything. I was just here rooting him on. And by the way, folks, he did pass with
yeah,
the colors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Alex, if you're listening.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and it was in a SR-22, my favorite.
So yeah.
Was like that. That was cool. Yeah.
And like I always say, you know, there's no such thing as a perfect check ride. He made some mistakes, and just like I had my check ride this past week at United, and I made some mistakes. And I, you know, we have a grading system at United where one is like you're walking on water. Everything is like miracle-like.
Yeah.
I've never seen those. I've never given them or received one. And so and five is where you crash, so we don't want to go there, no. But
Would they make you do some remedial training if you got a five, just to go there for
if I got a five, we'd be doing it all over again. The check ride is that you can't bust a check ride worse than a five. That's as bad as it gets.
But they wouldn't just send you off and say, yeah, go take your 370 or whatever it is passengers over to the China now.
We would get additional training. Lots of it. No, but thankfully, I've never been there, knock on wood.
Yeah, let's knock.
Action.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, no, but I came through with a two, and so did Alex.
Yeah, oh, good. Perfect.
That is awesome. So here's a question. So you've been in aviation for a long time now, and you know aviation has changed quite a bit. What, you know,
43 years I've been at 43 years.
Wow!
Yeah. Wow!
That's almost 35 at United.
Wow, that's all. I mean, that's
something
really
to be proud of.
Yeah, very. That's very, very, very cool.
Where do you think all this gray hair came from?
I know a lot of people that wish they had gray hair.
Yeah,
because they don't have much of anything.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead. No, but aviation must have changed quite a bit. You know, since from tonight to you know when you first started flying.
Boy, I'll say.
Yeah. So What are some of the most noticeable changes that you've seen?
Yeah, well, this is so obvious it's hard to, you know, to me over the last 40 plus years of aviation, the biggest changes have been technology.
Right.
I mean, when I first started, nod your heads yes because you know what I'm talking about. All we had in the airplane was a VOR. You know, there was no moving map, no GPS. I mean, just a few minutes ago, you listened to the weather at Valparaiso in an automated weather report that was being spoken by a non-human that changes every time that, you know, every few minutes it changes.
Yeah.
There was nothing like that. We had to look at a windsock to determine what the wind and what the active runway is. Now you can do it from anywhere in the world within seconds online, you know. And we have a TCAS system. Look at what the airline industry safety-wise, that's the biggest change. Is technology, what it's done for safety. TCAS is Traffic Collision Avoidance System in the airliners, which if we'd have had that about 20 years ago, we wouldn't have had the PSA 727 run into a student training flight in San Diego, which killed everyone.
Right.
Those kinds of things should really never happen again. Even if there's pilot error where you have two aircraft coming together, the TCAS system should and will do a pretty good job of, I mean, pulling you out of that. So we have terrain avoidance, GPWIS we call it at United, which is ground proximity warning system.
Yeah.
We have this new ROS system, runway awareness system that tells you when you're approaching a runway, even tells you what runway you're lining up for. So accidents like the one at Lexington, Kentucky, where they took off on the wrong runway.
Right.
Really should never happen again. So to answer your question, Al, I'd say technology, thankfully, you know, I mean, aviation is such a kind of a young industry. It's just little over 100 years.
Exactly.
But look where we've come in 100 years, thanks to Star Trek.
Yeah. Thanks to computer.
Those ideas. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, going to the moon might have had something to do with it, too. But
yeah. Yeah, right. No,
computers, just look what computers have done for us. So technology is awesome.
And, you know, we talk about some of those systems. Not too many years ago, just a couple, my airplane, the traffic went out of it, Skywatch. It didn't start up, and I thought, oh, my gosh, should I go? And then I remembered back to the 70s where it was always all you had was seeing a void.
Right, right.
Right? And here I'm questioning, should I go just because the electronic system is on? Like, what have we done? Yeah. What have we lost? And obviously it's a safety device, but we're dependent on it.
And look at autopilots, where they've come.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, now, I mean, referring again to the training I just finished a couple of days ago with United, we're learning a new procedure, a new approach, instrument approach procedure now called RNP, Required Navigational Performance.
Right.
And that system requires the pilot, the aircraft, to be like as close to 0.15 miles from being directly on course.
Wow.
Anything more than like 0.15 and you're exceeding the RNP for that approach. So as we're doing this approach, number one, it's so accurate.
Right.
It has to be so accurate that you're required to have the autopilot on. You can't be more than 50 feet off your altitude.
Wow.
Or 0.15 miles off course, which is almost nothing.
Right.
Otherwise, it's a missed approach. And during the course of flying this thing, the autopilot system is so fantastic that I was monitoring it. We were monitoring because, of course, you can't. They don't want you to touch the controls. Yeah. You let the autopilot fly it, for God's sake.
Right.
So as we're flying this approach, we're noticing that, I said to the co-pilot, I said, Larry, you're 0.01 miles off course. Be careful here. And you're 5 feet high. That's how close we are to the limits. But that's what you have. This is today's technology. It's so tight, and it's requiring us to be that tight on the approach. As you're coming in to fly these approaches, it's actually an instrument approach, but you're absolutely right where you need to be, and you just sit back and watch it, and it's phenomenal. We didn't fly that way in 1978 when I started with United. It was like we flew the CDI course needle on and tracked VORs. We tuned, identified, twisted OBSs, and did our best to keep those needles centered. Those days are over, folks.
You even moved your own throttles, I bet, back then.
Oh, yeah, there was what's an auto throttle?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Now you lose the auto throttle, now it's like an emergency.
Exactly. Well, you know what was... the airliner that I used to fly was the Embraer 170 and 90. The 190 had auto brakes. And one day I decided that, you know what, I'm not going to use the auto brakes. It was we were landing in Denver. I think it was 17 right, which is, was that the 16,000 foot run? It's one of the,
Was that the new Denver or the Stapleton Airport?
Oh, that was definitely the new one.
The new one, okay.
Yeah. So then
you were still in grade school when that was. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, I decided, you know what, I'm not going to use the auto brakes. And the captain was so nervous that when we landed, he's like, within 1,000 feet, four times, he just kept saying, just remember, your auto brakes are off. Your auto brakes are off.
Oh, boy.
And that was I'm like, I look over to him and I said, hey, we all came from 172s at some point, you know. So it was just kind of funny that,
That's an example, I think, of somebody who doesn't quite have the big picture, and I'm glad we're not using any names here, but
you
a little bit of common sense and good judgment. I mean, you are using way too much common sense there. 17,000, 13,000 feet of runway, you don't need a lot of auto brakes.
Yeah.
In fact, even the 777, when we land to the south on that long runway going into Denver, and we know we're going to roll to the end and turn off at the end, we won't use auto brakes on the 777 either. You know, just go into idle reverse, and by the time you're approaching the end of the runway, you're down to 80 knots, which is where you'd turn off the auto brakes anyway.
Yeah.
So it's just a normal, no big deal, right? You know, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah, right.
You do have an on and off switch for that. You don't have to use it.
You get to choose which spot it goes
in. A lot of people think we auto land a lot of times, but most of the time our landings at United, at least, are hand flown. So what you get is what's really happening up there.
Yeah.
Is that staying the same now that there's another airline involved?
Yet to be determined, but there definitely is a push for more automation. Use the automation as a tool, but they also encourage us to maintain our flying skills. So they don't want us to just become a bunch of button pushers, because there are times when you lose the magic and the systems quit. So you definitely have to rely on your stick and rudder skills, and you never know when that's going to come into play.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. I think I was very passionate about that in the airline, at least, just turning every once in a while, just turn off all the automation, and you know, heck, it was enjoyable flying. You know, just hand flying a big airplane like that.
Yeah,
you know,
it was just, well, when I flew the 727, I would turn off the autopilot at the top of descent at whatever altitude we were at, 37,000, and hand fly the descent all the way down.
Nice.
But that was when I was a lot younger and had a lot more brain cells. If I did that on the 777, I'd probably scare everyone.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Al, you asked Bob about the changes in the industry. What about from the student? I'll take you back to the GA aircraft. Has the student changed in terms of, I guess I'll leave it open-ended. How has that person now in the left seat changed from when you first started instructing?
I don't think the students have changed that much. Maybe in age. We have a typically a little bit older, more mature students now. Mm-hmm. And we'd like to see a return back to the younger students. We want to encourage the young people to get that spark of interest in aviation. I think part of that has gone away because the profession has lost a little bit of its, you know, glimmer
luster.
And its luster. It's the promise of, wow, you know, people used to look at airline pilots and say, wow, that's really cool. I want to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, now it's not that way. You know, the industry has taken a hit. So you have young people that say, well, gee, I don't want to do that. Then I'm going to be a doctor, attorney, whatever, CEO. Yeah, that's, if you really like to do it, then it's you don't do it for the money. I never did, but the money was good, and it's still not bad, but it's not as good as it was. So
right.
I think that's part of the reason we don't see the young folks. So to answer your question, if we see a shift in age, I think that's because more people are doing it now because it's something they always wanted to do. Like I taught my dad to fly.
Nice.
When he was 45 years old, he started learning to fly. Why didn't he start sooner? He had family obligations. He was raising four boys.
Yeah.
And he couldn't justify taking the money, even if it was $1,000, but that was when he didn't make any money. So I became an instructor and gave him free flying lessons. So of course he took me up on that. But his flying was something he always wanted to do but couldn't do it. Nowadays, I think we see a shift to the older people because again, it's something they always wanted to do. Their kids are grown up. They've got pretty good incomes now, and they can afford the higher cost of aviation. But I don't know how kids do it. I mean, to take how much does it cost now? What's the price tag on getting your private license now? It's I don't even want to guess, but I know it's a big number.
Yeah, I think it's almost a five-digit number now.
Yeah,
I hear. Depending, of course, you can rent some pretty old equipment, but with anything kind of state of the art. I keep hearing in the 10 to...
Close to 10,000
10
or around 10,000.
Maybe.
So 10 times as much as it was for me or us, that's a lot of money for a kid to come across unless you have some kind of inheritance. So
right.
Yeah. Oh, it is.
So I think that's a big reason for the shift in age. But as far as the motivation or the determination, I don't think that's changed hardly
at
all.
And the work ethic, and I hate to almost position as that, and I was talking, I think, even of yours and my generation, because Al's actually an earlier, younger generation. You're welcome.
Thanks.
Yeah. You know, the ones that say, I just want to pass my check ride, and their focus is on getting through, kind of not the journey, but just getting the destination, get the ticket, and not the wonderful things about learning all the way, or sitting
right,
down
right.
with a DPE to say, what did I do well, what didn't I do well, and
right,
gosh, I want to succeed with Bob, you know, that kind of thing.
I don't know. As an instructor, and maybe Al, you can back me up on this, I don't see too many people that come through the door saying, I just want to get through. You know, just give me the bare bones minimum. Just let me pass. And, you know, I think for the most part, people are sincere in wanting to go the extra mile, learn as much as they can about it.
Yeah,
you know, very few people. Just give me the rating, you know, and let me move on. You know?
Yeah, right.
Shortcuts. I don't see a lot of shortcut taking.
That's good to hear.
I would agree with that because there's some people that, you know, I think when a student is paired up with the right instructor, you have a there's a great relationship. You know, we talked earlier. We talked about this. It's just pulling that motivation. You know, it is the instructor's responsibility. I think that's more of a responsibility than or just is equal of a responsibility than teaching them, you know, good airmanship.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
again, that's part of our job too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not only keep them motivated, but teach them properly.
Yeah, right.
Safely.
Yeah, exactly.
Give them the lessons so they can
right.
do it. And if you do it correctly, you won't be scaring yourself. And if you don't scare yourself, you'll want to keep out and coming out and doing it. And
right.
you'll get better. But when you only have half the skills, it doesn't take very much crosswind or very much low visibility to get in over your head.
Right.
And then you're scared if you survive it. You know, look at John F. Kennedy Jr. That was a horrible, tragic
right.
accident, but it happened because he was in over his head.
Right. Absolutely.
And we have to ask ourselves, how did that happen, and how do we prevent our students from getting in that situation?
Right.
He was learning his instrument rating at the time.
Yeah. And that's a, you know, I think that's kind of an interesting way of looking at it, too, because now you have to teach them when to use good judgment, which I guess falls under the airmanship category,
right?
Because
right.
that's all part of it. But
mm-hmm.
You know, when to remove themselves, or
yeah.
when they can find an opportunity to learn something, or when it's time to just stay on the ground.
Right. Just like Mark has asked me before in the past, you know, how do you teach good judgment?
You
know, and there's an argument there. I mean, can you even teach good judgment?
Right.
Well, I think you can. Every time we go sit down as instructors. And sit down with the person next to us, judgment is what we display too. We're demonstrating our judgment every time we go up and fly.
Right.
What would you do? What you know, what's Bob doing? What's Al doing?
Absolutely.
So let's see. And every time we force them to do it the right way, we're forcing judgment down their throats.
Exactly.
Well, and the judgment, even taking it maybe beyond where we need to go at this moment, is judgment to me in the beginning was always about safe, 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 conservative, 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 conservative. But from you and Al and other people I fly with, I've learned to stretch the envelope in a safe manner.
Right, right.
But
yeah,
things that
yeah.
were always, oh my gosh, there's ice or there's...
Oh, there's 6 knots of winds, we better cancel our flight.
Yeah, right,
today.
Right.
Yeah.
To say,
there's
you
still,
know what, I
yeah,
can get that.
Yeah, you can still do the job, but judgment allows you to do the job safely. You still get to Iowa City...
Yeah, yeah. He moved to Cedar Rapids, so now I fly
okay.
Cedar Rapids.
New destination.
Yeah, I miss Iowa City Airport.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
yeah, no, exactly
yeah.
right.
Yeah, yeah, you still get the job done. You may get there later.
Right.
You might have to go around a couple of thunderstorms, but sometimes without that judgment, you can be so cautious that you end up not flying at all.
Right.
Exactly. That's what
yeah.
happens.
But then you can also say, hey, that thunderstorm is not taking up the entire world.
I'm,
that's why God gave us ailerons and rudders. We can turn around that.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah. Go the other way.
You know what? That's kind of an interesting point that you bring up. Because one thing that I've kind of learned, even you know, as a career pilot, and lately now, you know, being in my current position, you know, this it could be, if you look at the radar image, it could look like the, you know, Armageddon, right, on the
mm-hmm.
radar. But you start to use judgment, and you say, okay, well, this flight can actually safely be done. You know, and when you think of flight, or let's call it a trip, you know, let's say connect Philadelphia and Chicago together. Okay, that's the trip. But it could take multiple flights in order to get it safely done. You can fly in the sunny blue skies to wherever the thunderstorm is, land, let it pass,
mm-hmm.
sunny blue skies come.
Right,
and
right.
you keep, you know, it's kind of interesting is you get to that point.
Every day is different.
Yeah,
You know, when I do my flights to Shanghai or wherever I go, every day you flight plan that flight and look at the weather today. And the way you fly today may not be the way you went last week. You may have some detours.
Right.
Or change of altitudes go around. Every day you're looking at different options. Options, just like Scotty used to tell Captain Kirk.
Yeah. Exactly.
Captain Kirk would say, Scotty, give me options. So that's what it's all about. You got options. You know?
Yeah. I always, one of my new a philosophy that I've adopted is that it's a great day somewhere. mm-hmm. you know, in aviation. Mm-hmm. You know, wherever you're flying, it's a great day somewhere.
And even if it's not a great day right now here, if you wait a little while, it might turn into
exactly.
one. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Or 20 minutes later, it'll be a great day.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that there's a as soon as you learn how to maximize your options, maybe that's all about
mm-hmm.
judgment.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of more changes, look at what the iPads have done with ForeFlight thing and things like that. As far as looking at your locating your options, determining where the weather is, that technology wasn't around when we started. You know, to have. And speaking of my student, you know, that he took his check ride recently, he would be sitting on the ramp somewhere. He'd open up his iPad, turn that baby on, and show you know. There's the weather, here's the weather, and within a couple of minutes he would have a new flight plan all filed, and 10 minutes later we're picking up our IFR clearance. We couldn't do that.
Yeah.
So it's really exciting what technology has done for
Although
us.
Although I have to laugh, I'm thinking back to you, Al, with one of your students, and you were talking to him about how to get into and how to do a hold. And the way he did it, I see these guys, they're out on the ramp, with their arms to the side, pretending to be airplanes, and using the lines, the cracks in the cement as airways and things like that.
If Al was doing that, then he probably saw me doing it before, because I was doing that with my students too.
Well, it certainly, in this case, was a great way for that student to visualize.
Yeah, I had another student in the past, and I had a 50-foot rope. And I had laid it out in the grass,
nice.
And created a holding pattern shape. You know the big racetrack pattern.
Yeah.
And we were practicing holding patterns by walking in the backyard
nice.
Around that holding pattern, and we'd visualize winds and everything, and do teardrop entries and parallel entries.
Oh
and
wow!
So
who needs technology?
Yeah,
right. I got a rope and I got some grass.
one of the things you learn as a flight instructor to help make your job better for you and better for your students too is the ability to do things differently, and you don't just teach one way. Every student has a different need, and some people need to visualize, some people need to read it, they need to see it on video. But one of the biggest challenges for an instructor is to figure out what this student needs today. How does this student how's he going to get it?
Yeah,
and sometimes it means laying rope on the grass.
Exactly. Absolutely. I might have to say, I'm going to go to the hardware store and get a 50-foot rope tomorrow.
All right. Yeah. Right. Next week, you and I will be in the backyard here just walking around doing holding patterns.
Exactly.
And it saves a lot of fuel doing it that way, too.
It sure does. Absolutely. Well, I think that's actually really cool. You know, and one thing that I kind of want to touch upon is, okay, so the iPad. All right, so the iPad, I think, okay, it's a great tool and it's evolved aviation, but I think it's opened up a lot of potential for aviation and maybe even exposing, you know, people that aren't even in aviation to aviation. You know, we have great aviation software and things like that as training aids, but you can look at aviation videos on that. Well, you could do lots of things on the iPad.
Right, right.
And it's kind of, I think, pretty soon here.
Or the home simulators. Look what kids can do now.
Yeah.
If when I was 15, 16 years old, if I could have purchased a simulator program that taught me about what you can learn nowadays in aviation just from your own bedroom, you know, wow, I would have thought I died and went to heaven.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that the potential of a piece of technology mm-hmm. like that can really open up aviation to... You know, a greater audience, which I'm pretty excited about.
Mm-hmm.
I think, but I know one thing that when you and I have talked, you see a lot of potential in aviation, even you know sitting on all three you know different levels that you interact with aviation, and I think that's pretty impressive, you know, to see that, to kind of see that potential and be really excited. I mean, you've gone out in the area here in Chicago and given little seminars and, mm-hmm. you know, the potential of what's to come in aviation.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think?
Well, considering, you know, look at, again, considering the fact that aviation is so young.
Yeah.
I mean, a little over 100 years, you know, 110 years. 110 years is nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
In the course of human endeavors.
Right.
Look where we've gone in 100. How could we not have all kinds of potential? It's like we just started this thing called aviation. We just finally, you know, finally invented a way to become birds, and look where we've come.
Yeah.
In 110 years.
Right.
Just imagine what it's going to look like 110 years from now.
Yeah. Oh, it's going to be pretty amazing.
Right.
And I think
you'll probably still be here, but I'm going to be
you'll just be writing about it.
I'll be looking down with a big smile on my face. Tear coming down my eye.
Yeah. Well, no, I think that that's very fun, and it's really important to spread and talk about the potential in aviation, because I think that's so often shadowed by, you know, let's go back to Mark's example of, you know, the deadheaders. You know, the passion sometimes fizzles out and whatnot, so I think that's really... It's really neat and admirable what you do, going out and talking about the potential. Is it, you know, is a career, or you know how young aviation it is?
Yeah, I really haven't done too much career counseling, but that's there's probably a good bit of that that could be done. We're doing some of that tonight.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's right. And I had a conversation with a gentleman I was working with, and he was into cars. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about the youth of today, maybe for whatever reason, either it's money or it's too many distractions or too many options.
Right.
He says they don't talk. Remember we were kids, it was the GTO, the Pontiac Goat and all that. And he was a T-Bird guy. He says now they buy Neons and Souls and these inexpensive, they're not into the cars. And similarly, they just don't seem to think about aviation as an option. Mm-hmm. So somehow the word's either not getting out there, or I have the wrong perspective on what really...
Well, maybe that's part of the reason that kids are not... They might not seem to be drawn as much to aviation, because they have so much other options, so many other options to select. I mean, there's so much to do. What if you and I weren't watching TV, we were outside playing ball, right? That was about it. What else could you do? Ride your bike.
Play Army.
We didn't have computers.
Played Army.
Yeah, we didn't have computer games.
Right. Well, we didn't have computers.
What's a computer? Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And so now these guys and gals that, you know, make a very successful career out of programming and computers, it wasn't even an option.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that kids can do today, and so that's maybe the reason that, why would I want to sit down and talk about airplanes when I could be doing all these other things?
Yeah, I could create Halo, a game, you know, and that type of thing. So got to get to them early.
Yeah, I don't know what the options are, but I know there's a lot of them.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, okay, so we could take I would say a lot of the options are technology-based.
Mm-hmm. Right, I agree.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay, whether it's video games or software, computer, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of we just talked about the iPad and how it's a really kind of a neat piece of technology that's came about that could expose people to aviation. But I've always felt that aviation has been kind of on the 5 years behind the technology, you know, curve. And what I mean by that is that we have a electronic flight bags are starting to come to fruition, and you know, when they really could have probably come 10 years ago, you know, to be honest with you. And part of that's regulatory, you know, and everything needs to be approved and go through, you know, make sure that it's very reliable and things like that, which is important. But I think aviation is starting to hit that technology curve, the knee of the curve, and you know, there lies a lot of potential. You know, like ForeFlight. You know, you could be a really cool tech junkie and design ForeFlight, which is an aviation related product. So you don't necessarily, maybe being a pilot you could be a pilot as a recreational hobby, but you know your full time gig could be aviation related, being a computer software programmer, but for aviation. So I think that's kind of a neat potential, is that aviation is kind of spread its roots, you know, quite farther than just airplanes, jet engines, and propellers.
Yeah, well, even a lot of the airlines, several of the airlines are starting to have the iPads put in the cockpit.
Yeah,
the pilots are going, we just got our iPads at United, but we're still in a growth kind of a growing pain thing.
Yeah,
we don't quite know how to use them yet.
Right,
they don't even have the approach charts installed yet. So we're going to be getting that, and when we do, that's going to be a great tool. But we're taking it in baby steps. So even though the potential is there, there's a huge potential, because right now we just finally, I just figured out how to turn the darn thing on. So,
yeah.
So I'm, you know, but we're not using the iPad to fly the plane per se. It's a tool.
Yeah, right.
It's just another tool, just like anything else in aviation that they give us, like the RAW system. It's a tool. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't keep you out of the mountains, but it's a tool. Everything combined. So, iPad's a great tool, but and there's a lot of potential there, but. I'm
yeah right
at
no
at this point I can barely spell it
so. Yeah.
Well, I think as we've talked before is the concept of enabling technologies. So the ForeFlight doesn't exist without a tablet PC, right? And it's portable and comes into the cockpit. So now that's here, and it's not the old tablets that had to power up and go through operating system checks.
Right,
that
yeah.
was the problem before. Now I think we'll continue to see, just like ForeFlight and X-Wing and FlyIQ by AOPA, which is going to be coming out with a subscription service, as I understand it, and Jepson.
Yeah.
They all got on board because mm-hmm. the enabling technology now exists.
Yeah.
Right.
I remember the first time we had at the airline I was at, they went through an experimental EFB program, electronic flight bag program, or at least electronic charts, and... I remember I flew a flight to LaGuardia, and it was kind of difficult to switch between charts of, okay, you have to have an arrival, then your approach chart, and then the airport diagram, which, you know, the airport diagram at LaGuardia is the most important because you get, you know, taxi clearances blurted out to you, and you get to switch all to all these different frequencies. And as soon as we touched down, my flight bag or my electronic flight bag froze, and I couldn't switch to the airport diagram.
Yeah,
you know. So and so
Stock,
yeah.
Well, can you give us Progressive, please?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. One of the things that makes aviation unique is that a lot of what we do as pilots is so time critical.
Yeah,
critically time critical. Where have you ever noticed how sometimes you need something in the plane, and I don't mean in 3 seconds, I mean right now. It has to be done right this second, or it's not going to be pretty. And when you have those kinds of situations happen where you're relying on information that you need right now, and all of a sudden, blank, there goes your screen.
Yeah.
That is the problem. That's why we're having to take baby steps in learning how to use these technological advances called iPad or little electronic flight bags. We can't afford. The FAA won't allow, thank goodness.
Yeah.
The FAA won't allow us to have systems that aren't completely 100% reliable where, you know, your chart doesn't go away, the paper chart.
Right.
You know, so that's out. You have it clipped up. And we need to learn how to use the electronic flight bag, the iPads, so that kind of thing, what happened to you, doesn't happen.
Right.
And if there's a potential for that, for your charts to go blank right at a critical moment where you need it right now,
yeah,
that's a serious problem.
It is a very serious problem. And I think that's that's why aviation has been lagging. And that's what I mean by lagging behind on 5 years behind the curve, I guess, of technology, you know. And 5 years is kind of an arbitrary, nice round number, I guess I'd throw out there. But it's the reliability of the technology has to be 100%.
Mm-hmm. Right,
you know, it has to work 100%, or it, you know, or not work at all, or, you know, be removed.
I mean, it's nice to have your electronic flight bag or your iPad showing you where you are on the chart.
Yeah.
With the geo-referencing, and that's a cool tool.
Yeah.
But you also have to be able, and you alluded to it, to be able to navigate from one chart to the next as you need it.
Right.
Instead of just being locked on one taxi chart, you need that approach chart. You need the standard instrument departure, or the arrival chart. You need the en route chart. And all of a sudden, ATC gives you a clearance to hold somewhere. You got to have that. You got to be able to get to it on your chart so you can see what the heck they want you to do. So the ability to navigate on the charts takes time to learn how to do that.
Right.
Like right now, if you ask me to do that on my iPad, I'm a student pilot when it comes
to
the iPad. I have a long way to go. And that only comes with experience. Nobody can say, okay, Bob, here's your iPad. You're checked out. You're good to go.
Yeah.
You're ready to operate this thing in lieu of your paper charts that you've been using for 40-plus years.
Yeah.
Here's this new tool. Use it instead of your charts. It's going to take time.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah, so absolutely.
We have to mature into it.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's kind of an interesting point because there's a aviation human or well human factors is a I guess a relatively new discipline that aviation kind of brought on. You know, and that's kind of the interaction between man and machine. And it one of the things that it talks about is that hey, when you solve problems with technology, you actually create new problems. You know, and that's the
that you never saw coming.
Yeah, that you had no idea that was going to be out there. You know, which is kind of a neat a parody upon itself.
Look what you've done to me now.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's a you know, somewhere in there, there's a lot of potential in aviation, whether it's behind the scenes or behind the in the cockpit, behind a yoke and things like that. I think it's just there's a lot of cool things to come. You know, and like you said, 100 years from now, aviation is going to have a totally different face. You know, from a technology standpoint, a business standpoint.
Yeah,
it'd be very. You know, it's just going to be really exciting.
It'll be interesting to see what we're using for fuel then.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, just
seaweed.
Yeah.
Well, that's what's coming, right? The biofuels like from the seaweed. That and
yeah.
You know, I to your point also, Al. Especially since I started being on the show for now 2.5, 3 months, whatever it is, the people I meet doing all these different things in aviation, avionics and all, it's really made me think where that's going to go.
Yeah.
The young people today, I mean, you can create so many new things. That radios that anticipate a flight lesson, speech recognition, all of these things to make sure information comes to the pilot and from the pilot back to the airplane in a more efficient manner. And anticipates. I mean, I don't want to say I lay awake up at night thinking about this stuff,
yeah.
But I do think about what their future holds, and it certainly is much more than just sitting behind the yoke.
Right, right. Absolutely. Yeah, the automation that's taking place is leading toward eliminating sometimes the human interface.
Well,
yeah,
the unmanned actually kind of bothers
me. UAVs,
I suspect that we'll get there some point, maybe far in the future.
Right. Well, look at the flight engineer.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
I used to be one of those.
What?
I still
have a 727.
That was
can I have your autograph?
My first job at United, flight engineer. Yeah.
Wow. What model? A 727?
Maybe? Well, I learned on the DC-8. I was a flight engineer on the 737, which doesn't even require a flight engineer. And then I was a flight engineer on the 727 before I made co-pilot. So I flew it on 3 different airplanes.
Wow, how cool
is that? Mostly the 727. I did about, 7.5 years of that.
Well,
I
don't know why, and don't claim to be an expert, but when I think of flight engineers, for whatever reason, the 727 comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's 737. I don't even know if there's enough seats in there.
No. That really didn't. Yeah, that was just a 2-seat airplane, and I sat on the captain's lap, and it wasn't pretty sometimes. But.
I hope it wasn't pretty any of the time.
No, but the 727 was a real man's airplane, you know, and pardon me, ladies, but no, but we had the ladies enjoyed it, too. What I mean by that, it was a good get in there, and you actually had to do stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, the airplane didn't do anything by itself. If you wanted to change an electrical bus to a different bus, that required a switch to be flipped. Whereas, like, on the other side of that is this 777, where practically every switch in the cockpit is labeled off, auto, or on.
Yeah.
And you put it in the auto. Most of the switchers are just left in auto. The system is designed to know whether the thing should be on or off, and it turns itself on or off at the appropriate time. Good example is engine or wing anti-ice.
Yeah.
The airplane knows when it's flying and icing, and it activates its own engine anti-ice or wing anti-ice as appropriate, and just lets the pilots know, hey, I'm turning on my wing or engine anti-ice now. It's just sort of a notification thing just to keep the pilots in the loop. But it pretty much flies itself. I mean, it can fly itself, but...
Yeah.
And so many systems are that way on the airplane. 787 is another example of that. A newer, 787, which...
Have you seen a little bit of that at all?
A little bit of that. Not much yet. But, I mean, as far as the real 787...
Well, the real 787 or...
came through Chicago last week.
Excellent.
Our first one. So it's doing proving runs now.
Wow. Oh, that's neat.
Flying it across the country, and it'll be entering service... revenue service early November.
Oh wow, I'm really excited to see that. I think I'm going to hang out at O'Hare for a while until I see that. I just want to see that airplane on final, you know, looking at straight on, and the wings are just going to be flexed so high, and I just think it looks really cool.
Les Aben from Flying Magazine wrote an article about the 787 and this current, I think it's the current month's edition. It just came out
on
Flying Magazine, so... that
good
was,
article.
That was. I liked it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It, I remember too. I'm going to Boeing Field on Tuesday. That's where our LCA training, line check airman training, is going to be at United. We're going to get to see the Boeing Museum again, and maybe if we're lucky, even a close up of the 787.
Nice.
So I have to ask the question. You're a 777 captain, is there still time for you to go to another airplane? Will they say, hey, Bob, you want to get checked out in the 787?
There's time, I think.
Is there desire?
I definitely would love to fly the airplane, but I don't know for sure if it's going to be for me, because to right now the Continental guys, that side of the equation, are flying the airplanes, even though it's a United airplane. But, Continental was the one who purchased it. So initially it's being flown by the Continental pilots. It'll eventually be able to be flown by our side, the United, once we reach a collective joint bargaining agreement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it could happen. I just don't know. But in another way, though, it might not make sense too, because it's a smaller airplane than the 777, so it could result in a pay cut or
a reduction in pay.
So I don't know about that. So.
And so maybe this is an appropriate time to ask. And I told our listeners and Al today about when I got checked out in this little Sky Arrow.
Mm-hmm.
Today it was a thrill, new thing in the checkbook. So someone like yourself.
Yeah, that's on my to-do list.
Oh, good. On the Sky. So that was my question. Yeah. You know, you can't go after any more ratings, right? You got them all.
So no, I don't have them all. There's lots of ratings they don't have. I can't fly a hot air balloon or a glider yet.
So is that on
glider
the list?
Is definitely on my list.
All right,
I want to become a glider pilot someday.
Oh wow!
Well, I see. I thought you were that. All I understand that when a United pilot retires, they all go over to Huntley or something and start flying gliders. But we
I got my seaplane rating. That was very cool, and hopefully I'll do some more.
So bottom line is, you still have goals of things you want to add to your piloting experience.
Yeah, definitely. There's plenty of things I could still do in aviation. I haven't reached the. I mean, I'm not sitting down. I'm not doing the aviation motivated goals like I used to get my ratings and get my career going.
Right.
But those are definitely like, this is going to be cool. I do for sure want to fly gliders someday. I think that's going to be really cool. Just feeling those updrafts, and getting up there and going.
Absolutely. Paying $25 for a tow and be done with it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there was a guy, and when I was at U of I, I was part of the Illini Glider Club.
Mm-hmm.
You were part of a lot of little competitive teams, glider clubs.
Yeah,
involved kind of guy.
It was a fun time. They had a guy. So this is the get up there and forget about it type of thing. There was a math professor that was part of the glider club, and he was French. His name was Jan, and he showed up, and he wore these like a red and white striped shirt. It was like really tight, really short shorts, and he had his own like high performance glider. And it's like 8 a.m. He shows up, and then he puts. He also had his little hat, the one piece hat that. You know, it's like a detective hat, I guess, or I don't know what you call them, but safari
Sherlock
hat.
Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes hat or something like that. And he would get in his glider, and he'd be like, okay, everybody, I will see you later. And it's 8 a.m, and he'd come back at 5 p.m. And it was
amazing.
It was, I mean, talk about mastering... mastering a skill like that. Holy smokes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I love cars that get good mileage, but how do you beat that? Fly all day long and don't burn any gas.
Yeah, seriously.
I definitely want to get my glider rating. I want to get my seaplane rating. I want to get, I don't know, I was...
You want to get your CFI. You should become an instructor. Yeah.
I actually do want to.
And you should.
I know.
Absolutely.
I love teaching and I love flying, so I might as well combine them.
With your enthusiasm, and you have a natural propensity to teach people, you're
whether
very
they
good
like
at it
or not.
No, that's not what I meant. No, but I think you have a natural instinct for that. So I, I, of all the people I know, I think you would be a good instructor.
Thank
so.
You very
much.
Let
me motivate you.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
it comes down to it. The flying is exciting. Getting the knowledge test out of the way, I'm not as good as I used to be to buckle down and study and get those things done.
But you definitely have the motivation, so
yeah.
With that, the learning will come.
Absolutely.
Once you commit.
Now I feel compelled and and under, not under duress, but under the microscope.
Yeah.
Everyone's going to say, how's he doing on that? Did he follow through?
Don't worry about everyone else.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. Good point.
Yeah. Well, no, you should definitely do that. I think that's pretty neat. So gliders would be a riot. You know, I think one thing that's really neat about gliding is that there's so many different terrains that, you know, that are terrain features that you can go and explore, you know, such as flying a glider in the mountains or in rolling hills or out here in the cornfields.
Mm-hmm.
You learn all the different weather patterns and how that affects flight. And oh, it just sounds like a awesome adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Definitely. But anyway, I think we covered quite a bit of aspects of aviation that are pretty exciting, you know, coming up here. That I think it's got a pretty aviation's got a really great future and horizon. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. We talk about the potential. We talk about the changing environment. We talk about how far we've come in such a short amount of time, and
right.
We got a long time ahead of us.
Yeah,
right.
So it's a shrinking world, and
the sky's the limit, if I may say so.
Yeah, right. But I think one thing that I kind of got out of this conversation is that, hey, we have a responsibility. You know, flight instructors have a responsibility. It's taught to help pull motivation and passion out of a student. You know, that's an ethical and moral responsibility we have to our students. But I would like to challenge that and put that on, you know, all pilots. You know, I think that at some point, whether or not, you know, if the person or the pilot has lost their passion in aviation, that existed at some, you know, that passion existed at some point. So therefore, you know, I firmly believe that it's latent, it's hiding there, it's dormant, and, you know, it wouldn't take much to reignite that and, you know, also spread the good word to people that really don't know too much about aviation that have maybe one day thought, oh, that'd be kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's all. I think that's all you need.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, and that passion, that spark, whatever, is the same across generations, across genders, across different flying aspects. Everyone I've ever met has that same spark about, you know, looking to the sky as something that's really, really cool.
Yeah,
right.
You guys probably every time you're outside and you hear a plane overhead, you look up, right?
Oh,
actually, when I walk out, I didn't even realize I do this. I was at a department store, and I walked out, and I looked up to just see what were the clouds and to me, that was normal, and the person I was with commented. They go,
What are you looking at? I remember, you said you went to school at U of I.
Yeah.
I was there for my first year as a freshman, but I was studying engineering.
Nice.
And that wasn't nice for me. But I remember walking to class with hundreds of other students on the sidewalk, and out of the clouds on a solid overcast day, a nice IFR day, would become an Ozark Airlines, either DC-9 or F-227, you know, the old Fairchild 227s, and that was coming out of the clouds, and I would just stop in my tracks and watch this thing, and I was like, oh, this is so cool, you know, and everybody's like, what's that idiot doing, you know, what's he looking at? I was the only guy looking up and watching this magic called a jet come out of the clouds doing probably a VOR approach into Champagne.
Oh, man.
I told the story. I was living in St. Louis, and I used to go over to the McDonnell Douglas parking lot at Lambert, and all I did was take pictures of Ozark. I took everything, but Ozark was a lot there, of the Fairchilds and of the DC-9s. And then the security from McDonnell Douglas came and took my camera out, and they wanted to pull a film, and I said, no, don't. And I got my pictures back, except for the what were they making, F-15s there, I think, in St. Louis. They were all in the bays.
Wow.
Anything I took that way didn't come back to me, but I got my Ozark pictures back.
Oh, man.
Very nice.
Crazy security.
Don't take my camera.
The world we live in today.
Yeah. Oh, well, that was 19. When did I live in St. Louis? In our early to mid 80s.
Just imagine trying to do that today.
Oh, my goodness.
Probably couldn't even get close enough to take a picture, let alone.
Right. I'd be shot.
Yeah, detained.
Detained. That's a better, nicer way to think about it.
Question. Well, one little light bulb would be over Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, anyway, I think that's pretty neat. That was a great conversation, and as much as that almost felt like hangar talk in a way.
Yeah, I think we've transitioned into our, normally by this time we're well into hangar talk. I think we're already there.
Yeah,
we totally missed the target, didn't we?
No, I think we nailed it.
Okay, good. All right, okay.
That's what
a great segue.
I think in basketball they call that a swoosh.
I think that would be a swish.
Oh, excuse me.
You're talking to a basketball coach.
Yeah, but no, so... Well, that's very good. So, Bob, I've got a question for you. What's your favorite airplane?
Boeing 777.
Boeing 777.
That's your favorite airline. A lot of pilots like the airplane they're flying right now. And,
yeah.
And I've always liked the airplane I was currently on. But for me, it's hard to beat the amazing Boeing 777. The only thing I couldn't do is pay for the fuel that we burn on that thing.
Yeah, what was the thing gave me when we were talking about that a couple years ago about how much fuel it uses just taxiing down?
Oh, yeah. Well, I figured out last week that I burn, just on my trips to Shanghai, just my trips alone, we go through $7.2 million worth of fuel in each year that I'm flying. Just my flights, $7.2 million just for the fuel.
Wow.
Careful, they may want to get rid of you. Everyone else just does $6 million.
Oh, man. So, yeah, that's the scariest thing about aviation. What are we going to do when we run out of fuel?
Are
we going to have to find an alternative fuel? Because it took us eons to learn how to fly. We're not going to give it up just because we run out of fuel. We're going to find a different fuel.
We're up for the challenge.
Yeah, that's going to be the tough one.
As we've talked on other shows, from a pure looks perspective, I talked about the Beech Stagger Wing, which just holds a special place. But when you were kind enough to let me go out to Denver and get in a 777 sim, so as far as I'm concerned, I've flown a 777.
You have, yeah.
Right? And then in that same month, I got to sit right seat and take the controls of a Pilatus PC-12. And then after those two incidents, I got into an SR-22, and I said to my wife, actually, I said, you know, I think of all the three, it was exhilarating. My favorite, maybe because it was mine and it was doing something I want to do, was flying left seat in that SR-22.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's interesting because your favorite airplane becomes the one that you kind of master.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it takes a skill set. It's not just performance and things like that. You get to know each airplane on an individual basis and things like that.
I don't know if I'll ever master the 777, but that airplane is.
But it's home to you.
So yeah, I certainly spend more time behind the controls of that than any other airplane, and I actually get to fly it. You know, a lot of the GA planes, we as instructors.
Yeah.
We get to watch the other guy have the fun. We watch him and try to make him better through, directed training. But we don't actually get to manipulate the controls as much as I do on the 777.
But you say that, and I have to bring this up. Bob, how long does this take you to fly from O'Hare to Shanghai?
It's about 14 hours.
14 hours, and of those 14 hours, how much are you handling the controls?
A couple minutes.
Exactly. Well,
no,
whatever
that's not
it is,
true.
I understand.
Well, let me tell you that most of the guys at United, at least, typically will take off. You know, there is no such thing as an auto takeoff.
Right.
Every takeoff that you see in any airplane is a manual takeoff. It's a question of when do you turn the autopilot on.
Correct.
So at United, pretty much the procedure is to hand fly the plane up to it around 18 to 20,000 feet, typically. Some guys turn it on before or later, but that, I would say, is the average. So how long does that take? Probably 5 minutes to get to 18,000 feet after takeoff, maybe 5, 6, 7 minutes.
Yeah.
And then on landing, before landing, we might be hand flying the plane, typically, not just me, but this is a typical thing, usually the last 5 minutes or so of the flight. So the answer to your question, maybe 10 minutes.
10 minutes.
out of 14 hours.
Right, or even a half an hour with ground and all that.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
And to this concept we talked about earlier, not the bus driver so much, but say, well, that's your love, but you don't get to fly it that much. I guess it's cool to sit there, but does it get boring after 13 hours?
Well, just because your hand isn't on the controls doesn't mean you're still not flying it.
Good point.
We still manage. We have to manage the autopilot and all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
The plane doesn't fly itself. We have to tell the autopilot what to do with the airplane, when to go up, when to go down, when to turn left, when to turn right. Without our management, the autopilot wouldn't be very good. It wouldn't do a very good job. Yes, the airplane will auto-land, but only if we program it properly to do that. That's, you know, a very demanding task. But there there's lots of backups and everything, but you still have to monitor it. And even when it's making an auto land, my hands are on the controls.
Sure.
And my fingers are tickling the go around in the autopilot disconnect switch, because you never know when it's going to say, I give up. You know, just like you with the with your iPad
Your
electronic flight bag, all of a sudden, boop, it goes to bed. And now what? You have to be ready to jump in and take over. You're the human interface that brings the electronics to a point where people would be willing to get in the back seat. And, you know, if it weren't for the pilots up front, nobody would get on the airplane if they thought just the autopilot and the computers were going to do the whole job.
Somehow 12 hours or whatever sitting there,
it's not boring. Trust me.
Okay, it's not. So you answered the question.
Boring. No, it's not boring.
Oh,
no,
man.
That's awesome.
Now it is awesome. I want to go do that.
Between talking to air traffic control and doing all the other tasks that have to be done to manage the flight. Think of it like a cruise ship. You know, the airliner is a cruise ship. You don't just. There's a lot more to being driving a cruise ship than holding a course. You know, there's a lot of stuff, the periphery of, and that's what an airliner is. You know, you've got a lot of things to be concerned.
Can you see Bob
about
there at 20 minutes? Okay, switch tanks.
The 777 does it itself.
It's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, cool. So, what is your favorite GA airplane?
Oh, that's tough to. That if I knew that, I'd have one.
Yeah,
okay. There's so many. I enjoy flying them all. I've loved the J3 Cub, you know, and those kinds of planes. I almost got a seaplane, you know, the Aviat Husky with floats.
Oh, man.
And I was going to have that in my backyard until my neighbor said, "No, we don't want an airplane in our backyards too." So forget about that. Saved me a lot of money, but that would have been a cool way to get here tonight.
Yeah, right. I would have been over at your house like nonstop.
I'd have a lot more friends.
Actually, we were over at an air park today, and it was so neat to go in the guy's backyard and open up the garage, and there's an airplane, and then across the street, there's a hangar coming up with an airplane in it while he's cutting his lawn.
That's my idea of retirement.
These people, one guy looked like a retirement, the other one looked like he looked like a young guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's I think that's on the aviation dream list.
The bucket list.
Yeah, the bucket list.
The bucket list. Yeah. To live in
it. When they take away the keys for my 777, I'm going to have to work on answering that question. What's my favorite GA airplane? And then I'll have to get one.
He'll end up back in a Cherokee 140.
Yeah. Right, right. I don't know if I'm going to have one that goes really slow. And one that goes really fast.
That's a great problem to have.
Yeah. I've always enjoyed the variety. That's one of the things you were saying before. You do so many things in aviation. It's because I love the variety of it.
Right.
I like going low and slow. I like going high and fast. I like sitting in the left seat of an airliner. I like sitting in the right seat of a GA airplane. I like teaching. I teach in the airliner. I teach on the ground. It's fantastic, the options that we have available, and that's so much fun for me. That's why I do it. That's why I love it.
And that's good.
The variety.
We had a pilot from American flew an MD-80 in the club several years back, and I remember saying, "You get to fly the MD-80. This is really cool." And she said to me, "I like to fly low and slow too."
Yeah.
Right? And so it speaks to just what you did.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. I think that Sky Arrow is that's kind of one of my new favorite.
Yeah,
just boring holes in the sky airplane. That's just
boring as a verb, not as an adjective, as my wife would describe it.
That's a great plane for taking aerial photography, right? It's got awesome visibility. And
take the back windows out.
You can open the back window, right? The perfect place to have your camera. Just don't lose your camera.
Exactly. Wow.
Yeah, no, the Sky Aero, I guess the first time I flew it today, it was great. The only thing that is something I'm still trying to figure out is you need three hands when you land.
Mm-hmm. Throttle brakes.
Yeah, because the brakes are on your right hand, your fingers. Your stick is in the right hand, a side stick, and then your throttle on the left. And so just as you touch down, you better have that friction lock in so you can reach around and grab this and this over on the right side and then
brakes,
come back.
Yeah.
And then I'll do that all that without hitting your push to tuck.
How is it for landing? Is it pretty...
I was actually, I hate to use the term worried, but I figured, oh my goodness, because the owner had said, hey, don't worry about flaring, just keep it level. It flared just like a regular airplane, and it's a little bit lower to the ground, right? But you got that sense as soon as you took off about how low. So the sight picture was exactly what I imagined. Raise the nose, just keep it off. It was an airplane. And Al told me, because I don't have experience with gliders, that it very much handled like a glider.
Yeah, it's a wonderful airplane.
Yeah, and again, for all the old timers that say today's pilot doesn't know how to use the rudder, you got to be active on the rudder. you move the stick over. If you don't do rudder, the right. If you move the stick to the left, the nose will go to the right. Right, unless you get that rudder in there. Yeah,
it's amazing how that happens.
Your brain's like, what?
That was great. I want to go. Let's go back up right now.
Fun flying that at night.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? But just like in a bubble at night, it's the views out of that thing would just be incredible.
And the props behind you, so nothing in the way.
A little bit magic carpet-like, isn't it?
Yeah.
I like that. That's good. I always said if I had three wishes, I would get one of them would be a magic carpet.
If I had three wishes, my first wish would be for 1,000 wishes.
You're so smart.
Yeah, right.
Well, I know I couldn't just go with three.
Yeah, three is not enough.
Bob, where'd you get your seaplane rating?
Jack Brown's.
Oh, nice. That's where he just got it last week.
That's a great
Oh, last
place.
Week? Last week?
Or
like
it was
recently?
A week ago or two weeks ago.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, that's a fun time down there. I mean, they do a really
nice
job.
I got mine about 15 years ago.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. From was John Brown give your check ride?
That's his son, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the sons, the father had already passed away.
Yeah.
But I can't remember if it was John or Jack or...
And what airplane are you in for that?
Yeah. The C whatever they called it, the 85 horsepower non-amphibious J3 with the floats. So,
yeah, those are a lot of fun.
Is that what you were in?
I almost failed my check ride though.
Why?
On the glassy water landing.
Oh, we talked about that.
Yeah,
last
that
week.
Was the toughest one, and they didn't want you to be changing pitch or power, just kind of leave it alone. And I felt it settling in, and I needed a burst of power, and I didn't do it. And we hit the water pretty hard, and he had to actually, reach up there. I made him nervous. I made myself nervous.
Yeah.
So, but he knew I could do better. So we went and we completed the rest of the check ride, and he let that last landing coming home be another glassy water attempt, and that one came out a lot better.
Yeah.
I had it carried a little bit more power. I remember he asked me, what could you have done to make that landing better? Yeah, I use that question a lot on check rides that I give.
Yeah.
What could you have done to make that better?
You were a DPE back then.
I was, I was a new DPE, yeah.
Oh, so did you use it as an experience, like to see how the other DPs operate, or what was your attitude?
Yeah, it was a good learning opportunity for me as a new DP to see how a very seasoned DPE would deal with things like that. So every time I see a check ride or observe an event like that, it's hard to not come away with something. Just like we always say, you learn something at every check ride, whether you're giving them or taking them.
Yeah.
So I learned something giving check rides too about not only the human part of the equation, but how people learn and how they react when under pressure and
yeah,
You know.
Absolutely.
Even though I've probably taken over 200 check rides during the course of my career at various levels, you still have a little bit of nervousness going into each one. You just don't know how, you know, just like the other day, I'm taking off out of Hong Kong in my simulator, and I didn't know. I mean, even though I kind of knew I had to what I had to do, you just don't know what's going to happen. So.
Right.
That's interesting. I wouldn't think that you'd get check ride-itis.
Not so much that it's debilitating. That's check ride craziness when you when you're so afraid that it turns into debilitating fear.
Right.
You don't want that, but it's normal. If you're not a little bit anxious about it, then you're probably not alive anymore. So there should be some trepidation there. A little bit of that is good. It puts you on alert.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
Absolutely.
It helps you perform better.
Definitely. I think there was that. It was interesting. It sounds like your check ride of the seaplane was pretty much identical to mine. I remember there was one where I felt okay going into, or pretty good going into it at least. And then, you know, you sit there. I don't know what happened, but I just kind of tensed up, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm getting my seaplane rating right now. This is a check ride. Oh yeah,
yeah.
And then they So then they, but you know,
I don't know if we can say this on the air, but that's probably a little bit like a brain fart.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
Yeah,
and there was the last landing was used for a demonstration of, you know, keeping the power in just a little bit longer as well.
Yeah. I didn't adjust the power, but I needed more power going into it. For those who maybe not know what the glassy water landing is, you basically put the airplane into a slow flight attitude, carrying just enough power to let the airplane not stall, but not go down more than about 50 feet per minute. That's what you want for a descent rate, at that 50 feet per minute, and you just, it takes up a lot of lake that way.
Yeah.
But you're carrying just enough power to keep it just above the stall, nose up above the horizon, just hold it, let it come down gently 50 feet per minute, and finally the floats touch the water, and it's just it's magic when you do it right.
Yeah.
I actually got to do some real glassy water landings several years later in the Bangor, Maine area.
Really?
Yeah, and those are really cool, yeah.
I bet that must have been a riot up there. That's got to be really pretty.
It is, yeah. But just getting in an airplane and seeing, you know, because in training when we did our glassy water-like approaches and landings in Florida, it was always windy. So
yeah.
You could see the waves, you could see where the water is. The deal with a glassy water landing is that you can't see where the surface is. It's like if you've ever banged your head into a mirror or something, or a glass pane,
right,
a sliding glass door that you didn't see there.
Yeah.
Well, that's what happens if you don't do the glassy water technique in a seaplane. You don't see the water coming, and you hit the water doing 500 feet a minute down descent rate.
Yeah.
And it flips you over.
Yeah, exactly.
An instant crash, you know.
Yeah.
So you got to do it right, or it's one of the more challenging, because you can't see the surface.
Right.
You're blind to where the surface is.
Right. It was interesting because I was trying. That was a weird concept that I was having to wrap my head around. You know, you think like, oh, okay, well, you know where the water is. You know, water is just like land. You know, and you can set a pitch attitude reference to that, and you probably could get a really good judge for that. So then, so I was asking him, like, my instructor, why is it so difficult? He's like, okay. So he brought me over to a window. He said, okay, see your reflection? I'm like, yeah. He's like, all right, now where's the glass?
Exactly, right.
I'm like, oh, now I get it.
And it's hard not to have, it's easy not to have a respect for how potentially hazardous the glassy water landing is, because when you see an airplane landing on glassy water, you go, wow, this is perfection. You know, the water is completely glassy still. And the floats touch the water, and just, oh, it's so pretty. You think, wow, that's got to be the easiest thing. Why would that be challenging or difficult or risky?
Yeah.
The risk is if you think you know where the water is because you're looking for the water, you don't even want to try to look at the horizon and just hold that attitude and just let the plane come down until it touches the water. Oh, there's the water.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
Got it now.
That was the thing.
So you got your rating, what did you say, 10 years ago?
Yeah, about 10 years ago.
Would you get in a seaplane today and fly?
Would I? Of course. But yeah. Could I? No. Because I'm so uncurrent. But I would love to, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think my point is, I got my tailwheel endorsement a few years back, but I haven't practiced it, and so I wouldn't feel comfortable, and that's what makes me say, you know what, maybe I won't get my twin, even though it'd be a neat reading to have, because
yeah,
I can't
stay current,
proficient.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So. Well, anything in aviation requires constant refresher and training, and you can't instrument flight or basically anything. You don't get the rating and then put it down and come back a year later and say, okay, I'm an instrument pilot, let's go fly in the clouds. You've got to stay current. And the same thing with seaplane rating or glider flying or
right.
You name it. That's why we have this thing called flight review.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Then there's that.
And that's minimal. That's right. Of course, the FAA requires that flight review every 24 calendar months, a minimum of 1 hour ground training and 1 hour of flight training. And that's that. And you can get by with that if you're flying regularly.
Right.
But there's no way a person who hasn't been staying current could get by with that minimal amount of time and say, okay, yeah, you're good to go.
Yeah. Well, Al took us out today, and we did the, what do we call it, the traffic run?
Yeah, we'll call it the traffic
basically
run.
Basically fly the roads downtown between the United Center and the buildings.
In the
fly
Sky Arrow?
I want to do that.
That'd
it was
be
in the Dakota. There was four of us, so I hope it wasn't in the Sky Arrow, because that's only a tandem two-seater. It was great. And so, that kind of thing is about going and having fun, but practicing and practicing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
No, yeah. When I was learning, I did what you did, except I wrote down a list of everything I wanted to do. They used to call me 7/10 Bob, because every time I went up, it seemed like my flights would be 7/10 long. I'd come back and pay for 7/10 worth of flying, which is, 42 minutes of flying. So I would be able to take off and go out to the practice area and practice all my maneuvers that I wrote down, come back and do a couple landings and do the whole list. Stall, slow flight, steep turns, forward slips, turns, S turns around a point, or S turns, come back for a couple takeoffs and landings, and then 0.7 was my time.
Yeah. Of course, back in the 70s, it wasn't oil pressure, it was just the master, so he'd shut off the master while I was out there for 2 hours.
Right? No, that wouldn't work. It was, you're referring to the Hobbs meter, of course.
Yes.
No, that was an oil pressure switch, even back then when I was learning to fly.
Not in the Pipers we were in.
Oh, really? No, I didn't get any free time. Either that or I wasn't smart enough to know that.
You were in engineering. I think you were smart enough.
Yeah. Oh, wow. They had there's down at U of I, instructors would, when you were flying the Seminole, they'd come in, they'd taxi in, and the right engine would be turned off. As soon as you land, boom, right engine off. Taxi into the ramp, because that would kill the Hobbs meter as you taxied in.
Single engine taxi, that's kind of tough in a Seminole, isn't it?
It was.
So we can taxi single engine taxi the 777 even at maximum takeoff weight.
Wow.
648,000 pounds.
Wow.
Single engine taxi. It works great.
Yeah. Wow.
I was in the cab of O'Hare, and it wasn't a 777, but you could tell somebody was using a single engine, because they said line up and wait, and the guy said we got to start our other engine.
Oops.
The controller wasn't too happy.
Oh. Yeah, that's what you call bad planning.
Timing is everything.
Yeah, what were you doing down there? Oh boy.
Well, can you believe it?
Yeah, don't tell me what you're about to tell me.
It's my worst. It's my least favorite part of the night.
The end of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking at the clock.
Now it's time to say goodbye to all. No.
A-L-E-X-W-A-T-E-R-L-O-O.
It's not that kind of program, I know.
Yeah. Yeah, a sing-along.
22:03 here on the clock in the KPWK radio station.
Yeah. Well, this is a Bob. We really appreciate you coming on the show tonight.
Thank you, guys.
This has been pretty entertaining. I've learned a lot.
Pilot is always learning. Yeah, it means you're a good pilot.
Exactly. Well, no, I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I've been smiling this whole show. I could tell my cheeks are
I feel like mine are burned into that spot. Yeah.
I have the same sensation.
Yeah.
But I feel like Jack Nicholson in the Joker in Batman, he had that cheek high.
Oh, yeah.
Stick on me.
Yeah, right. Seriously. No, but this has been a lot of fun. This has been a really fun show tonight.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming over at such a late hour.
No problem. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll definitely keep everybody posted on new potentials that we find in aviation. I think there's going to be a lot of them, you know, whether it's business-wise, career-wise, technology-wise. I think there's just some neat things that are about ready to happen.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The industry needs it. So, but anyway, unfortunately,
we are out of time.
We are out of time, and until next week.
Same time, same channel.
Sunday night.
Sunday nights, 8 p.m. Central, and until 10 from PWK.
This is Simple Flight Radio. Thanks for joining us. Al Waterloo signing off.
Mark Eppner doing the same, saying tailwinds.
And blue skies. Have a great night.
This is Ethanolive Internet Radio. www.ethanolive.com.
Simple Flight Radio, ready for takeoff.
What do you think about flying? Is it a sport? A business? Is it easy or difficult? Is it boring or exciting? Alan Waterloo and Mark Eppner think it may be any of those things, but they like to make it simple. This is Simple Flight Radio, where Mark and Al talk about the many aspects of aviation and the amazing people doing amazing things to make this world a better place.